Take a network break. Welcome to episode 58. Grab a coffee and a virtual donut and join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Connery Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. Ethan, you're home. Greg, you're in the wilds of Portland. Is that correct?
When I got to Portland, I thought, oh, this is going to be great, because I do have a bit of a fetish for drinking port on the odd occasion. Every now and then, you know, not often. And so I said to the guy, where's the nearest port shop? And he said, we don't have any in Portland. And I thought, people in America have got really bad naming conventions. You know, they really need to work on some sort of consistency. You know, if you're going to go to, you know, to a place called Portland, it should have port in it.
I'm sorry we disappointed you.
Again, America's an endless disappointment.
Endless disappointment to Greg.
I like it here. The hotel's got infinite bacon. There's lots to love. I was just down there and I'd eat some bacon and then I would go back and there'd be more bacon. It's like magic.
That's right. Trying to make up for the whole port thing.
That's it. Yeah.
You know, all right. We have a ton of news to get to, but before we do, I just want to say thanks to this week's sponsor, Viptela. You've heard of Viptela. They're a hybrid SD-WAN company, and at their SD-WAN technology unifies your MPLS, lease line, and internet-based WAN infrastructure so that you get real-time visibility and policy control for precise and measurable application performance. Thanks, Viptela. All right, jumping into the news, guys. Obviously, the big story is Dell and EMC. We talked last week about speculation. This week, it's actually happened. We're getting some more details. And Wired came out with an interesting article calling Dell, EMC, HP, and Cisco the walking dead, essentially that they are zombie companies who don't know they're dead yet because of so many changes going on with cloud and mobile that the impact is still going to be felt.
Well, I thought the walking dead was a little bit too strong. I you know, like you could say that in terms of the stock exchange, if your business isn't growing, you know, if you're not going to make more profits next year than you are this year, if you're not going to get more revenues, if you're not going to get more of something, then your share price falls. Even if you stay at the same revenues and produce the same profit year on year, you're no longer what's called a growth stock. You're a dividend stock, and dividend stocks don't go up in value. They stay fundamentally static. So if that's walking dead, which it isn't, then okay. I think that we're seeing this trend. You know, I believe that we're seeing this commoditization trend, you know, the move to x86 custom to merchant silicon, x86 in servers, and switch silicon is merchandising. The chip that, you know, making hardware has become cheap because we sell it in such large volumes because we sell so much of it now, whereas 10 years ago all our hardware was highly expensive. I can still remember spending $20,000 on an x86 server in the late 90s. And yet today you wouldn't even dream of paying. You know, that just isn't realistic. These companies need to do something. Now, the analysis that I've read is this article is a little long on hyperbole and, you know, whatever, but I've read some other financial reports which point out that the best way that these companies can maintain their growth is to get bigger. If you're making, you know, 100,000 servers in a year, how do you keep growing your profits if you're only selling the same number? And the answer is make a bigger manufacturing plant so your per unit cost is cheaper, so then you can sell them for the same price, hypothetically, and then increase your profit margins and continue. The thing to remember is that all of these companies, Dell, EMC, HP, Cisco, all operate on enormous profit margins. ENC has a gross margin in excess of 80%. Cisco runs in excess of 60%. HP operates in the sort of 50%. The vast percentage of the revenue that they take in is gross profit. So anything that affects profit instantly flows through to the bottom line. These companies either have to get bigger or they have to get more focused on what they do so they can cut the cost of those goods. The classic, you know, discussion that I have quite often is that EMC in the storage market is charging such a high dollar value and making such high profits, you know, 90% gross margin on a deal, that 40 or 50 storage companies can exist under the overhang of that business and sell for half the price of EMC, still make 60% gross margin, and be perfectly successful businesses without having to work too hard for it. Are they the walking dead? These companies definitely need to change. They're going to be forced to a change to some level. Cisco's betting its business on on a number of different things. One is they're moving into adjacent markets. So they're moving into UCS. They're moving into software. So now they're moving into microservices and OpenStack and selling OpenStack as a product. And also, very importantly, they're going to start selling services. And where before you used to buy IBM professional services and they'd help you, soon you'll be buying it from Cisco. They'll have a lot more engineers. They'll come on your side and configure your OpenStack for you and so forth. And they've told the market that they intend to grow that services revenue by 10% per annum for the next 5 years, which is a lot. It's very hard to hire headcount and grow that business. So are they the Walking Dead? I'm not sure. What do you think, Ethan?
Point of the article from the author's perspective was, well, everybody's moving to cloud. All these people sell to the enterprise market. And so therefore, you know, these people haven't changed quickly enough to adapt to new IT business models. And therefore, they're the Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. And I tend to agree with you. It's a bit of hyperbole. Mm-hmm. You know, the cloud people have to buy from somewhere, too. So if we're shifting workloads out, let's just say that's the case. We're going to shift workloads from enterprises doing it in-house, moving it up to the cloud. The cloud still needs compute. The cloud still needs storage, you know, and so on. Yeah, the business model is going to change for these guys. I think that's pretty evident. But, you know, the Walking Dead, I mean, it's not like they're going to be gone in 5 years or even 10 years. They're right. Just not going to be the same companies we see today.
Sorry. It struck me as a bit glib as well, which is fine. It's made for an amusing headline. But I do think there's some truth to the fact that they do need to adapt. There is a significant change coming. And we can see evidence like the HP, the Dell EMC merger and HP splitting off, that you can't run the business like you used to. But to call them the Walking Dead seems premature.
Makes a great headline, though.
It does make a great headline, because here we are talking about it.
Well, okay, so let's talk about the EMC merger, and probably the best place to start with HP. There's an article on SiliconANGLE about an email that Meg Whitman sent to all the employees about. They're going to borrow $50 billion to fund the buyout, and as she highlights, that they have to pay $2.5 billion a year in interest. That's a big suck on your profit, on the bottom line of your profit margin, to make that deal come to town.
That's right. Yeah, the whole tone of the email was essentially saying, here's why it's going to cause a lot of disruption in the market and you know, some pain for Dell and EMC as they get their act together, and we're going to take advantage of that disruption and get ahead of them.
You know, the way I read her email and what it said to me was that integration is hard. And so she's really criticizing and saying, oh, it's not going to be a successful thing. Integration's so hard. And that's obvious. You know, duh, yeah, we get it. Integration is hard. And, you know, HP is one of those companies that to me has demonstrated that it's really hard because they've not been great at it over the years themselves. So I think the bigger question is, what new products might come out of the Dell EMC merger? As I saw one person put it, run Dell EMC or run DMC. Oh, yeah, harken back to the 80s. What's up? What new products might come out of this coupling that would make it harder for HP to compete? So if you say, you know, the whole business of these people, right? And this kind of goes back to the first article we were talking about. What do these people do? They sell arms. They sell arms to, you know, for infrastructure. And if we assume that business is dead, at least in the enterprise space, because, you know, everyone's going to move to cloud. I don't know if that's a safe assumption or not, but let's say it is. Then enterprises are still going to need network infrastructure. You know, so that's one piece of infrastructure that remains. Storage, maybe that mostly goes, and compute, maybe that mostly goes, but network is there. Dell is well-positioned arms dealer in that case. And the Dell networking story, since we're a networking show, right, gets even more interesting. They've hosted the open networking flag, and they keep waving that thing around. And that play is interesting to the hyperscale crowd now, but all of a sudden it becomes possible for Dell to jump off the back of the VMware relationship, if you will. I mean, they own the company, right? And imagine a tight coupling of NSX with a Dell open networking platform and then selling that as a unified stack. It gets pretty interesting. And then think about the open switch project that's come up now, which I guess is HP, right? But if it's open, anybody can use it, including Run-DMC, as well as Open Network Linux. The foundation is already there for Dell to have a highly integrated one-stop offering for any enterprise today and for the hyperscale networks tomorrow. You can go all the way up and down. That's a scenario.
Well, yeah, but in the detail, Dell is moving its enterprise headquarters from Austin, Texas to Hopkinton, Boston, Massachusetts, wherever Hopkinton is. It Boston?
Massachusetts.
It's in the Boston area, roughly, yeah.
EMC is effectively becoming the enterprise business unit. And so I perceive that Dell's saying, we haven't overachieved in the enterprise, and EMC's coming into the fold, and it's got, you know, really deep hooks into the enterprise through its storage part, long-term storage partnership. So we're going to make it the center of that enterprise world. So selling
right,
service.
Dell Storage has not set the world on fire, right? They bought Ecologic and Compellent,
yep.
And neither of those have, you know, again, set the world on fire. You bring the EMC element into it, and now you've got a multitude of storage options up and down the stack. Does it make sense for EMC to be the, you know, the center of that? I guess they've got more of the relationships.
Well, you want to maximize when you spend $50 billion to buy, you want to make sure that you're going to get $15 billion worth of value.
But that's all the short-term viewpoints, though, isn't it? I mean, aren't we talking about what's going to happen next year, you know, and maybe the year after that, as opposed to the long-term play? Because I think long-term, and again, going back to that Wired article about The Walking Dead, we got to stop thinking about IT markets in terms of storage, networking, and compute, you know, all the silos that everybody sells into now, because I think eventually that goes away. And it becomes converges. About building blocks.
Converges is a huge story. I'll talk more about this later, but you know, I've been a guest of Intel here in Portland this week talking with their data center group and getting a really good vision of how Intel sees the vision of the data center. And this idea of having a storage array as a separate piece of physical box is not, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Doesn't fit into Intel's worldview, for sure.
I think Dell has got all the pieces to eventually deliver that sort of a super hyper-converged model. And HP, on the other hand, is splitting up the company. So, you know.
They're only getting rid of the desktops and the PCs, so the consumer market. They're not throwing out servers or, you know, software platforms or management, you know, the software or any of that sort of stuff. They're still keeping 3PAR and Compellent and everything like that. So what they're really getting rid of is ink and consumer stuff.
It's funny. In some ways, Dell EMC is kind of making a new HP because Dell will still have its personal line of devices and stuff.
So it scales up. Ironic. Right? So if you think about it today, EMC cuts a manufacturing agreement with a company. Who's got the most effective manufacturing operation out of the big vendors today? Dell does. Dell's an awesome time and place purchasing machine. They have their absolute focus on their, you know, their internal processes to commission manufacturing of products and deliver them with just in time. It's going to be a huge benefit to EMC because EMC has had internally enormous problems getting its accounting system in order. You talk to staffers who work there about the expense claiming system at EMC, and you just hear nothing but unhappy thoughts coming out. You know, like internally,
you'll hear that at most companies, though.
Well, you will, but apparently EMC's is legendarily bad, and in EMC IT, its internal IT organization is apparently pretty unfriendly to users as well. They have this really super control over their employees, and they don't let them do anything with their tools that are outside of a certain narrow scope, which restricts your productivity, quite honestly. But if that's the way the company wants to run its business, it can. I mean, I want to point you to StorageBot, which is Martin Glassborough. He's a storage manager. He is actually a manager of a very large company that runs a very, very, very large storage infrastructure. And he wrote about it. He said, look, you know, he's put 9 points down about this, but the big one is for him is that culture clash is going to be pretty big. If you take the EMC culture and then you mix it with the Dell culture, one's a retail, fast-moving, low-margin business. EMC is a slow-moving, high-margin, very stuck-up, very staid, conventional business model. Dell's very loose, fast, and rough. They're going to have a real challenge on their hands to make those cultures match.
Well, I think that was also going back to Meg Whitman's point that kind of integration really is hard, and it can distract managers and executives who should otherwise be running the business as they try to integrate those two cultures.
Now, talking about VMware, there's a lot of financial bajiggery going on to make the deal worthwhile. They're issuing a specific type of share, which is called a tracking stock. They're going to offer people who are existing shareholders of EMC and Dell will be given a bunch of shares in VMware, but they're tracking shares. They're not actually got any rights. And the market hasn't responded positively to that. So VMware's down 5 to 10%. It's bouncing around a little bit. EMC's share price hasn't popped because nobody believes that the financial people don't believe that the value's in there. They think it's fairly valued at its current price. If it's a fair value, then it'll go ahead. But Dell, there's also a $2 billion break fee. So if Dell pulls out for any reason, it's a $2 billion penalty fee. That's not petty cash, you know. So there's a fair bit of commitment in there. VMware will continue to be an independent entity. The question is, will they look to sell off all of the shares in VMware into the market to recoup that, to repay debt, to pay down the debt that they've raised? Who knows what they'll do, but I think that's likely. They'll need to get that money back, because paying $2.5 billion in interest, if you start selling VMware shares and then making it a self, you know, into the open market, you can probably do all right.
What's interesting and sort of perplexing to me is Elliott Management, who was the activist investor at EMC, who has been advocating for essentially divesting VMware to quote-unquote unlock value. I'm still trying to figure out how this deal is structured that they walk away with more money, because that would be the whole point of doing it. And I haven't figured that out yet. And maybe that's something down the line that's going to happen, but I'm still a little bit confused there on what Elliott gets out of all this incredible mess.
Incredible mess.
Maybe their shares, you know, I'm sure they'll be looking into it, but their shares, you know, they'll be getting a dividend and a bonus, and it's hard to explain, and I'm not really interested in doing it because I'm not a financial expert, and yeah, it's incredibly boring. But
my assumption is that they have structured the deal in such a way that they get their guilt.
I feel confident that that's happened. You don't around being an activist investor, and because keep in mind, they're not buying shares. They rent them from people who own them. So they go and do a deal where they buy the rights to vote on somebody else's behalf. They're paying a fee to rent those, to ownership of those shares. So they need to get their money back. Yeah, that's usually how it's done. I'm not just saying that it is in this case, but, you know. So let's talk about the competitive position. Where does this leave HP? Because HP is, while it's splitting up, splitting to focus on its enterprise, so it's forming a $50 billion HP enterprise, which is not quite as big as a merged EMC and Dell, but it is pretty big. But this focus might be able to produce better sales volumes and pricing for them. But also, what's Cisco going to do, of course, because we know what IBM's going to do. IBM went and bought SoftLayer, and it's getting into the public cloud, getting with its customers. It bought Blue Box to do OpenStack for the private cloud, so they're going down that path. Cisco's left with some gaps in its portfolio, so does it go out and buy storage startups? Or how many storage startups does Cisco buy to fill out? I don't know. It's going to be an interesting time.
No lack of choices, you can say that.
Yeah, you sure can, yeah. I feel that Cisco might be able to buy like several storage startups and then conduct a throw them all in the Colosseum and let them duke it out and see who survives.
That's right. Two arrays enter, one array leaves.
Yeah. Well, they bought one array.
It seems like that would be a UCS-focused set of acquisitions, whatever those would be. They'd be offering a fully converged stack at that point, built around UCS, which is, as we said on the show before, has got a lot of market momentum, and people seem to think really highly of it. They buy whatever storage they buy and then just build that into UCS offerings, and now it's a converged play, and it looks good, but it doesn't move the ball forward from a standpoint of you know, how long are enterprises going to keep needing arms dealers? You know, that problem. It's a short-term play, not the long-term play.
Okay, so before we go on with the rest of the news cover, I want to mention our sponsor, Viptela. Thanks for being a sponsor. Viptela's hybrid SD-WAN technology, it brings together MPLS, leased line, and internet-based WAN infrastructure so you can combine, mix, and match as you like. It's also packaged with centralized administration and real-time visibility and policy control so that you get precise and visible application performance. One of the good things about an SD-WAN is you can build flexible, multi-segmented topologies. So, for instance, your branch site could have guest Wi-Fi, video, PCI, and each application gets on a different segment and possibly a different topology for each. So you could have mesh, star, hub and spoke, depending on your application and the needs. Greg, and you want to tell them a little bit more about Viptela?
First of all, what I want to tell you is that on the 4th of November in New York, we are doing another live event. We did one of these, Ethan, what was it, around about May, April, May timeframe?
Yeah, at the Spring Onug event, we got together at a restaurant, had a nice meal, and recorded a live show with Viptela and some of their customers.
And now we're going to do it again. That's been so much fun, and was such a great success. We've been invited to go back there. So if you are going to be in New York on the 4th of November, and for most people that might mean you're going to be attending the Onug Open Networking User Conference, but even if you're just there, you can go over to the link in the show notes. It's on the Viptela website, an evening of SD-WAN nerdery with Viptella and Packer Pushers. We'd love to see you there in the audience to hear us interview customers. So what we're actually going to be doing with that event is recording a live show with real, actual customers who've bought and deployed Viptella and talking about their experiences, which is the last event was really cool because we were just talking to customers about what they got, and that's what I'm really looking forward to doing. The thing about Viptella, of course, is that their SD-WAN solution has several major features. Now, this flexible multi-segmented technologies means that you can combine authentication, encryption, segmentation, and service chaining to bring isolation. Now, if you are one of these organizations who needs to provide PCI compliance or you want isolation of data. So imagine if you've got a large branch network of stores and you've got cash register information, you're offering guest Wi-Fi to people who are shopping in your store, you've got the corporate applications, maybe you're running some IP telephony. Wouldn't you like to have four WANs, one for each of those? And SD-WAN can now deliver that. In the past, that would have been unimaginably complicated to configure and to match everything up. And in an SD-WAN where you've got a controller which helps you with the configuration and provides decision support and configuration operations, you can now start to create these multiple virtual WANs out of one physical WAN. More importantly, or what I find absolutely fascinating, is you can also configure the shape or the pathing of those virtual WANs for each one to have a different architecture. So you might say, I'm going to run all of my PCI data over a private MPLS network, and I'm going to do that in a simple hub and spoke architecture. But you might want to run some other stuff over the internet, and you might want to create a point-to-point multi-star or a multi-hub type architecture. With Viptella, you can do that. So what you want to be able to do is to take your WAN management in-house, build an overlay network from multiple service providers so you can put them in a room and let them have a cage match as they fight over giving you the best price for raw bandwidth. And then you can manage that application performance with the tools in the Viptella platform. So New York, 4th of November, come along, get onto the website and register.
All right. Thanks, Viptella. And we will have the link to the live event in New York on November 4th. Hope to see you there. All right. Believe it or not, there was some tech news this week that was not about Dell and EMC. One of those news items is Intel. They released their quarterly results, and they are definitely being impacted by cloud computing. According to the story from the New York Times, Intel's PC segment brought in $8.5 billion for the quarter, but that's actually down from $9.2 billion the year before. Meanwhile, in the data center business, it's on the rise. That's $4.1 billion, but still significantly less than the PC side is making.
So as a guest of Intel this week, I actually have that. I see that as a result of Intel making moves to make itself more attractive to cloud computing. If you think like back in the late 90s and through the 2000s, Intel made one type of CPU, one for servers, one for desktops, and we all got that. About during the sessions that I had yesterday, if they measure workloads across all of their customers, so not clock cycles, not CPUs, not whatever they're doing, they look at what workloads are running. There was this really interesting data that they piped up where they said 17% of their traffic of their workloads on this x86 CPUs come from telcos, 35% comes from public clouds, 25% comes from the enterprise, and another 25%, give or take, I think it's 23%, comes from high-performance computing. So what they're now saying is instead of having one CPU that appeals to just the enterprise, I should make CPUs for those four markets, telcos, high-performance compute, enterprise, and the cloud market. And because of that, they're seeing greater sales. Now, one of the interesting things is because they're now producing new CPUs, faster CPUs, better CPUs, customers are actually rotating servers at shorter and shorter timeframes, 2 years, 3 years, instead of 5, 7 years. If you think about it, what is it that makes our equipment obsolete? When we go and spend money on assets, hardware assets, what is the incentive for vendors to obsolete those assets today? And the answer is not much. If you're a vendor and you've manufactured a product, you've sunk the cost, you've got the spares, you've done the internal training on the product, you've developed the software, changed all the bugs, what you actually want to do is sell that for the next 40 years and just steal all the money and put it in the bank and give it to shareholders and for the maximum amount of value. You don't want to sell it cheaper. You want to sell, you've paid the money to get it work. You don't actually want to obsolete it and go and invest another, hundreds of millions of dollars on new silicon, new products. But it's in Intel's interest to force the market into obsolescence so that people come back and buy another CPU. And there's a really interesting tension, it seems to me, that we're moving into this SDN NFV where you don't use custom CPUs. So now you're going to see firewalls running on x86 VMs. And Intel's going to be out there producing CPUs that make you want to throw the hardware out faster because it's good for their business. I think this stacking chips in the cloud is that's what's happening here.
So do you feel like the fact that they're building chips specifically for different market segments could also increase their own cost, though, because they've got to have different production facilities to do the specifications on those different chips instead of just making one chip and then having that benefit of scale where they just make it over and over again?
One thing that they can do is keep wanting more features in the CPU. So, for example, for cloud, they're talking about putting FPGA functions into the CPU die. And that means that when you're in the cloud, you can now program those FPGAs to deliver certain functions. Maybe you could do some GPU encoding, or maybe you could offload some network processing using FPGA. I'm not too sure what the exact answers are. For public cloud, that's possible because they would custom develop the software that does the things that they want it to do. But I don't think an enterprise wants a CPU with an FPGA because they would look at that and go, hiss, hiss, mark of the devil. Something's changed. My God. I've got at least 20 years before we'd imagine doing something new. So they'll keep the more conventional. And you've also got this change. Another sort of differentiation is companies like Google want to have big CPUs. They want just a few cores but faster and faster clock speeds. So they would rather see Intel try and make them faster, pull less power, but clock faster and get more cycles quicker. But there's other companies, sort of Facebook is one example. They would rather see wimpy CPUs like Atoms that would have thousands of parallel cores and each one runs a single job. So they're working to diversify their production capacity in that space. But at the same time, the PCs, you know, how many CPUs do you sell inside of laptops and desktops? But that market's shrinking at a fairly fast rate, 5 to 10% per year, that market's shrinking.
Well, that certainly fits in with the notion that they need to compel their data center customers to refresh their product line more frequently, because the PC market, based on quarterly results, is still twice as big. They're getting twice as much revenue out of it as they are from the data center market. And as that PC market continues to collapse, it's unclear if the data center market is going to increase at the same rate to make up for that lost revenue.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Was there any talk of Intel getting into the mobile space? Because as we've been talking about PCs, I've been thinking about my shiny new iPhone 6S that's got a Samsung or whoever else is making the A9 chip for Apple. Intel's not in there. Do they get into that space? Is that discussed at the
Well,
event?
I was talking to the data center group. That's not, I wasn't doing an analysis
part of the
entire thing. I'm sure Intel wants to be in that group, but at this point in time, that's a different battle. I don't think we want to be talking about that here. I think they certainly are working on it. When I was at the Intel Developers Forum, again, as a guest of Intel, disclosure, last year, they released a prototype of an iPhone-like thing running Intel CPUs. So I know they're definitely doing things in that space.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll. But, if there's one thing about Intel, it's a long game. They don't play for, they're not going to burst into a market in one quarter like some enterprise companies can, or a year or two even.
All right, so moving on. So here's a company we don't talk about very often, Walmart. There's a story out this week that Walmart is bringing some software open source. It's called OneOps. It's a startup they acquired. They've been using it as a way to shift workloads from around competing clouds. I think they're in Azure and Rackspace. Clearly not Amazon for reasons you can probably guess. But now they're bringing this technology to the open source market for others who might be interested.
Yeah, I did some reading on this blog post and just kind of dug through. It's not a very detailed blog post, but they kind of give you the overall value proposition of what OneOps is all about. And OneOps is fundamentally an abstraction layer for cloud. Walmart didn't want to be married to specific cloud provider APIs to spin up infrastructure as they needed it. Rather, they wanted to be able to move to whatever cloud provider happened to be offering the best option for a compute problem of the moment, if you will. So other features in OneOps seem to be some kind of orchestration. So to quote from the blog, they say OneOps empowers engineers to spin up a new environment to host their app in a matter of minutes without having to spend hours specifying the intricacies of a specific cloud environment. OneOps models all of that for them. So it's kind of reminds me of a service catalog, like you would see in a typical public or private cloud offering, where you could pick a menu of services that you're looking for, and then just have all the magic get spun up in the background. OneOps also deals with lifecycle management, which would be the handling, spinning up, deployment, licensing, spinning down of virtual machines. And again, it's cloud provider agnostic is the big deal here. So since they've open sourced this thing, I can think of some use cases. So there could be other vendors with an interest in making it easy for their customers to manage, to handle cloud, could take OneOps code, look at it, and if it's manageable code, which is a big question mark so far, I think, build commercial variants. Kind of like, what Red Hat is or what Mirantis is. OneOps could be integrated into OpenStack as maybe a hybrid cloud module. You use OpenStack to build a private cloud, and maybe you integrate OneOps to somehow call out and integrate a public cloud into that scheme. A system like Nuance Networks maybe could deal with it, or a company like Revelo that today only works on Amazon or Google Cloud could use something like this to spin up Revelo workloads on a variety of other clouds. Now, their product's pretty tightly married to AWS and Google, I think, so I don't know how easy it would be for them to do that, but it's kind of an interesting question. Or you've got a crowd, cloud providers themselves could say, oh, you want to spin up infrastructure that runs on us? We got a plugin module for OneOps. You'll make it easier for them to compete in that space. Of course, then all of this begs a lot of questions. Again, is that code any good? Because we found complaints of, yeah, there's an open source project that does this, but the code is so bloody awful to work with, no one really wants to build on the project much further. So that'll be interesting to see as the developers get in and try to vet that code, if it's useful. Another angle on the code, maybe it's too Walmart specific to bother with for most. Is Walmart's business so unique that OneOps isn't useful for other people? Hard to say until people get in and start trying to do something with it. Then who are the competing efforts in this space? I was thinking about this. I can't think of anybody that's doing cloud abstraction, but maybe there's something else out there that OneOps is just late to the party. And then, of course, how full featured is it? Are some cloud providers maybe going to resist it? Because, of course, cloud providers want you to be locked into their infrastructure. So they're going to make it difficult to use OneOps in certain circumstances, maybe. It's an interesting project, and I can think of a lot of possible groundswell that it could get here.
I think cloud lock-in is going to become an issue going forward, particularly as we talk about all of the market transition happening with enterprises going into the cloud, moving away from their own data centers. And Amazon is saying, sure, come on in, because once you're in, we got you. I'm also waiting to see how long it takes before we start getting some Amazon backlash, where Amazon becomes the bad guy like Microsoft used to be, or the way we talk about Cisco sometimes as sort of the evil empire. So I'm intrigued by this move by Walmart. I also wonder if they see folks like Google and Facebook and the Open Compute Project thinking, hey, this is kind of a cool thing, and maybe it gives them a little bit of street cred out in the technology world.
What I see is these big companies picking up on open source software because it allows them to deploy thousands or tens of thousands of VMs without any licensing fees. There's a fundamental result there. And while it costs you money to replace, to build up your own skills inside of your IT team to run OpenStack and to overcome, ultimately OpenStack is still very early in the development cycle and it doesn't do all the things that your VMware does. You look at what Walmart's doing. They're using OpenStack. They're saying it's making money for them and they're going to start contributing the code back. Compare that with the article that from Light Reading, where BT stood up at the OpenFlow SDN conference in Germany this week and said, OpenStack doesn't do what we want. Wah, 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 whine, 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 complain, complain, complain. We're going to go somewhere else because doesn't do the things that we want it to do. BT says, we expect you to do everything for us. But Walmart says, hey, it's an open source project. We've got people writing code. We're going to contribute it. We're getting OpenStack developers onto our team so that we can make sure that OpenStack does the things that we want. Sure, we have to share it with other people, and sure, we have to do well with all of the OpenStack politics and the vendors getting together and all of that development stuff. But you know what? That's also training and education. You're actually bringing OpenStack skills into your organization by putting them on the OpenStack project to contribute code. So when something goes wrong, it's your support mechanism. So for BT to sit there and say, well, it doesn't do this, it doesn't do that, what they should be doing is saying, we need to buy 10 developers who are working on the OpenStack project can get involved so that it does do the things that they want them to do, so that they can, you know, make it what it is and avoid the cost of licensing commercial software.
Yeah, my question to BT would be, where else are you going to go?
Yeah. And if you do, so let's say you go to VMware, are they going to be able to build a competitive cloud business paying VMware licensing fees on every VM?
Not price competitive.
Wouldn't be. Might be service competitive for a certain type of application, but is it going to be price competitive?
The answer is no.
It's hard to see how, yeah.
All right, some more news coming out of the open networking space. Onos, the Open Network Operating System, which was a project, I think, primarily backed by AT&T. It's essentially a distributed SDN controller for doing SDN and NFV. They were run out of On Labs, which was a joint venture between Berkeley and Stanford to incubate some new networking technologies. Now they're moving over to the Linux Foundation. The deal about Onos moving over to Linux Foundation is that there is already an SDN controller project under the Linux Foundation called Open Daylight. So hey, what happens when these two projects collide?
Well, Onos, we've talked about on the show before. I mean, fundamentally, it's a different controller architecture than ODL, and that's the big differentiator. Onos is distributed. Controller operations can be spread across as many COTS boxes running controller software as needed to get the scale required. At least that is the big idea. And so this made telcos happy, as they were looking for controller infrastructure that can handle millions of operations per second. You know, our early reports on Onos was that it wasn't living up to the scaling claim, so I don't know how that's progressing for them, because they keep issuing releases pretty rapidly. Once a quarter, a new Onos comes out. And then, speaking of AT&T, I don't know how, you know, that they're the, you know, incubator, the, you know, the driver behind Onos necessarily, but I know they're one of the companies that's been interested in it. But anyway, they've said no controller meets all their needs, and there is an AT&T slide I've seen that shows different types of controllers used in different roles. But beyond that distributed controller architecture being the distinctive for Onos, I'm not sure what else it's bringing to the table that's unique if you compare it to ODL. There are more developers, a lot more developers contributing to ODL than Onos. Then again, ODL is a more mature product. And so the question that people are asking, so we just going to merge these two? Is that really what's happening here? Because you got ODL and Onos. And there was a blog post by Neela Shocks, who's the, I forget his formal title, executive director of the Open Daylight Project. I'm not sure he's what his exact title is, but certainly he's a spokesman and an arbiter, someone that brings people together from the vendor and customer community around Open Daylight to make sure that project is heading in the right direction. And if you read that blog post and you kind of read between the lines, I think what Neela is advocating is that, competition is good, but, do we really want to split efforts between multiple controllers that are awfully similar projects? And he, as I interpreted his blog post, this is strictly my interpretation, Onos is going to be assimilated by ODL eventually. They're going to take the best parts of Onos, and it's going to get merged into one project somehow or another. It's going to take time, but I suspect that's what the ODL folks would like to see happen.
Yeah, that's my take too. And I don't even think you have to read between the lines to get that perspective from Neela's blog post. He seems pretty clear that, you know, talking about the number of developers working on each project, how ODL has so many more, and the lines of code and the backers, that his plan, and who knows how it's going to work inside the foundation, but his plan is that these two things should eventually merge.
Yeah, he doesn't come right out and say that specifically.
I guess not,
though.
Right.
So I didn't, and I don't want to put words in his mouth.
Okay, that's fair. Greg, do you have any thoughts on this?
No. You know, sometimes with open source projects, this, you can just get too close to the sausage machine, and you actually end up going through there with it. And, you know, these are the you know, if Onos merges with ODL, fine. If it doesn't, fine. And I was talking to somebody about it, and they said that, you know, AT&T sort of started Onos. Now it needs to have a caretaker. AT&T has pushed it out, you know, kicked the 15-year-old out the door. It's as far as it, and now it needs to get other people to join on board. So passing it to the Linux Foundation makes sense. Whether it merges with ODL or not, whatever, not too bothered. Let's just let time take its course and see as the product matures. It's a bit like when there's, you know, some vendors like to bring their products out and start selling them to you 3 years before they're ready to ship. Right. Okay. So let's just go short. Let's wait and see when they're shipping. Let's take a closer look.
Right. Well, I do think there is a plethora of open source projects going on in the industry right now, and I don't know what the holding capacity is for all these projects. At some point, I think you've got to start seeing some consolidation or just letting projects kind of wither away of their own lack of interest. So we'll see what happens. That brings us to the end of this week's show. We have, I think, covered everything that we need to cover. Thanks again to our sponsor, Viptela. Don't forget to check the show notes for our link if you want to come see the Pack Pushers live for our presentation with Viptela at ONUG on November 4th. And Ethan, where can folks find you if they want to hear more from you?
EthanCBanks.com is my blog, and I'm at ECBanks on Twitter.
And I'm Greg Farrow. I'm on EtherealMind.com, and on the Twitter is at EtherealMind.
I'm Drew Connery Murray. You can find me on packetpushers.net or on Twitter at Drew_CM. And hey, check out our new newsletter. We're calling it Link Propagation. We put together a weekly dose of essential news, announcements, and must-read blogs. We send it to you once a week. It's free. If you go to packetpushers.net/link-propagation, check it out. Sign up. We hope you like it. Thanks for listening to Network Break. As always, Network Break is powered by Virtual Donuts. Virtual Donuts. Joe Tucci from EMC is going to walk away with $27 million for selling to Dell. Everybody else gets Virtual Donuts.